Sorry, are we still recording then?
We're still recording, just in case.
Anyway, we were going to talk about some Sawtell news, weren't we?
All the shops
are playing musical chairs at the moment.
Yes.
It's very, very exciting for us here in Sawtell. Viv's chip shop, which we were very sad about closing down a few months ago. I bumped into Viv's on the election booths last week when we voted for a hung parliament. And Viv told me that he's actually bought Atkinson's real estate, which you commented on yesterday, I noticed, which I thought was very funny. I marked that as a favourite post of mine.
It was absolutely delightful. How much of the whole story did he tell you?
I got a brief summary. I don't think I got the whole story.
When he retired, retired in inverted commas, after 23 years of running the fish and chip shop in Sawtell, because the shop had closed, he was actually able to attend a Chamber of Commerce meeting, and he sort of implied that there was something about the way that he chose to retire that he wasn't entirely happy about. And it turns out that it was basically problems with the estate agent who managed the shop, which was Atkinson's.
This is all strictly hearsay, of course.
This is all allegedly, I should say very, very allegedly, as Atkinson's are managing the house that we're currently sitting in. and I have absolutely nothing against Atkinson's, though. I think they're a splendid bunch of people. However, I must say that I've long suspected that the real estate entrance examinations consist of two questions. When you apply for a job in real estate, they give you this two-question test. Question one is, do you own a suit? Question two is, if the answer to question one was yes, when can you start? Because I've yet, again, Atkinson's lovely people, but I've yet to see a real estate agent who's absolutely blown me away with their intellectual capabilities.
Yeah, I actually think being a real estate agent is quite a tricky job, because a lot of it is reading humans. I mean, you're acting as the middleman or middle woman between landlords and tenants. And sometimes landlords or tenants can be complete bastards.
Yeah.
And you have to sit in the middle of them and try and make everything work. And I can imagine quite often you would just get really bored of doing that. And you just smile nicely and go, just pay your rent, or just don't bug your tenants or kick them out every 2 minutes.
And there must be some shocking tenants about. I mean, you would know this as a landlord yourself.
There must be. I seem to be quite lucky. I generally kind of, I like to either make friends with my tenants or just keep them at an arm's length and keep it as strictly business where they pay for their home. And I think a lot of landlords prefer tenants to pay to borrow their home. So they're not actually giving them rights to live in their home. They're just giving them rights to live in the landlord's home. Because I've been in places when I've been on both sides of the coin, where I've been renting and the landlord comes around and just lets themselves in and starts mowing down all the plants you planted in the front yard. And you know, you think, what the hell are you doing? This is my house. But of course, it's the landlord's house, and that's what they think. And I think it's not tricky. It's not hard. Landlords should just piss off. They're getting paid for it.
Yeah.
And as long as you're not burning the place down or blowing the place up, then, you know, they're getting paid to let their house become somebody else's home. And if you want to stick a poster on the wall, they can go jump.
Yep. Yeah.
And myself included, as a landlord, you know, I mean.
Well, I mean, I've had good and bad experiences, and just been surprised by both. One place, I rented a house with my girlfriend at the time in Guildford, and when we moved out
in Australia.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Guildford in Western Sydney. Not Guildford.
Ignorant poms like myself.
Not Guildford in. Where's Guildford? Is that in Surrey or something?
Yeah, somewhere southeast.
Somewhere.
Yeah. There. Home counties, probably.
Yeah, when we moved out, I got a call from the estate agent saying, well, oh, we're deducting $800 from your bond or whatever because there's so many weeds in the front yard. And when we moved in, the front yard was dust. And we at great personal expense, we brought in truckloads of topsoil and planted grass and whatever. And apparently we did too good a job on that, and he wasn't happy. So I had to argue with him that actually, no, the weeds were an improvement on what was there when we moved in, so we didn't owe him anything. But also a place that myself and a friend rented in Bondi Junction in eastern Sydney for about 5 years because we were both sort of dissolute bachelors. We, you know, cleaning the place was basically what we did before, immediately prior to moving out, and not at all before then.
I thought the fried eggs off the ceiling. Yes.
And I thought, oh my God, they're going to inspect the place and we're going to lose, you know, squillions off the bond on this. And the estate agent came in with actually the landlady or the landlord's wife or, you know, what, someone who had a stake in the place. And they were wandering about and saying, oh, they've kept it very tidy, haven't they? And I was, how bad are some of the other tenants? But actually, I know how bad some of the other tenants were because had an awful lot of exchange students, had some kids downstairs. There were like 12 Japanese exchange students living in the flat downstairs. The whole place was just, because they used to play Japanese techno music, that thump, 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 na 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 na. Anyway.
Carry on, I was enjoying that.
And it'd just be this one melody going over and over and over again, and the thump, thump, thump at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'd hammer on the door and someone would open the door and you'd sort of peek past them. And the whole floor is just covered with mattresses because there's that many people living in the place. And it's just one long, continuous party. And eventually I just got to the point where I used to go downstairs to the fuse box and switch off their power.
You could have just moved in with them and saved yourself a whole lot of angst.
Well,
you would have gotten used to it and you would have probably paid less rent because you'd be sharing with them all.
Well,
you might have actually liked Japanese techno music. See, in London, the problem they have there, my brother used to live in a bedsit in a very large, narrow house, a bit like the Blues Brothers. It was next to Kentish Town Railway Junction. So there was, you know, 35 railway tracks stretching off into the distance outside his window on one side, and then there was Chalk Farm Road on the other side with traffic roaring up and down, and he was up on the third floor in this little bedsit. And he had a room next to him which had a guy who was into industrial thrash metal, and he used to, I think they actually, the two of them used to mount their speakers against the wall pointing at the person next door. And my brother's sort of idea of heaven was to go out and buy a new amplifier so that he could crank it up just that bit much more.
Mm.
And I think the two of them just had this vendetta to try and deafen each other. And my brother used to get very annoyed and go out and leave his music on, you know, and go out and party all night or go out during the... And just quite often he'd put the music up full before he went out, and the other guy did the same. And wasn't very healthy, and you feel. I think if they took down the walls, that they could have just. They probably would have been best of friends. They
could have set aside their differences.
That's right.
Why can't we all just get along?
They could have shared their amplifiers and speakers, and probably deafened out the whole of North London. You know, drowned out all that traffic noise and train noise. And
So that's landlords and tenants. But getting back to, so I think the implied and alleged subtext here was that Atkinson's and Viv did not see eye to eye on many things,
which is entirely natural.
Yes,
they're landlords and tenants.
Yep.
Actually, no, they're not. They're people in the middle. Real estate's in the middle, dealing with landlords and tenants. Who is the landlord? Does Atkinson's own that place?
I don't know who owns the arcade.
Maybe there's some evil CMS person with a black cape and collars turned up, you know, who walks around snickering.
Who knows? It might have been owned by that Coops Martin pair who are currently
if the landlord's listening today, please call in next week and we'd love to hear from you. We have suggestions for improvements which could be very profitable for both you and us.
Yeah. So
shops moving around.
Yeah, shops moving around. So Viv saw that Atkinson's office was up for sale. pooled his money and bought it, and gave Atkinsons their marching orders.
And gave us all the satisfaction of finally watching a real estate agent
packing his belongings up into cardboard boxes and having to move at short notice, which is something that...
It's poetic justice.
Something that I personally experienced about three times in as many years when we first moved up here, and I never want to experience again.
Now that we've laughed and enjoyed that, yep. Atkinsons will be sending you your marching orders. You realize
yes.
that? You'll be packing boxes next week.
I think, touch wood, we're fairly safe here, I think. So in addition to that little bit of drama, the corner shop, what's the name?
Well, the seven till late, or whatever it's called.
I've forgotten the name of the couple that run it. It's awful.
I can't remember their name, but I will say hello.
Yep. Anyway, they're renovating, so they're moving their shop into Gary's Fruit Shop. Gary's Fruit Shop is moving into one of the abandoned shops that's on First Avenue that's due for redevelopment should they ever find people to purchase it.
So he's moving out of the little yellow brick arcade, public toilet arcade.
No, he's moving out into the former hardware store.
Into the Chinese restaurant.
Virtually opposite.
But he is moving out of the Thai restaurant. The low public toilet brick.
Yep.
Arcade. So that, they're going to fix up that place?
Well, my understanding is that they're just renovating the corner shop, but I don't know. There might be more to it. I've yet to make inquiries on that score. But actually, I think, you know, even though this is supposed to be temporary, that's a much, much better location for Gary's Fruit Shop because he's on the street.
It's a bigger place. It's half the distance for you to walk.
Yeah.
Your diet's going to improve vastly. Instead of going to the chip shop now, you can... Actually, the chip shop is closed. So instead of going to the corner shop and having the strange meat slice they have on the counter there, the fruit shop's closer. So you can have fresh fruit and veg. Excellent. Well, that's a win situation then. Yep. I can't think of any other news in Sawtelle. Surf's still flat. The surf report from young Evan, he goes and looks at it and comes back and says, it's been flat for months.
Oh, dear.
So I don't know what's happening. I think there's probably a large... squadron of whales keeping the waves down at the moment out there, but there's no waves, but that's to be expected. In the winter the waves will get flatter.
Yes, that's the thing. There's less energy in the system and less
stuff
happening in the atmosphere and whatnot.
I don't care.
No.
Whales, there's less whales too. Well, I don't know about less, but we haven't seen any whales yet. Apparently I was talking to the coffee shop which overlooks the beach there, you know, at the surf club. And they said, oh, yes, we've seen whales. And I sat there for a good hour or so with the kids, and I didn't see a single whale. But
I don't know. I'm awful at keeping track of this, but I get the impression that they're mostly migrating past in the autumn and the spring.
That's the egg-laying season, I believe.
Going one way or another.
They need to go to the Arctic where they collect nest material.
Yes.
And then they bring them up north and make large nests off the coast of Cairns, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lay these large black pearly eggs and they hatch out into the whale larvae, which flies around with albatrosses before becoming small whales.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is. David Attenborough has taught me a lot. Anyway, and that brings us to... Any other news in Sawtelle?
No, not really. Cameron's due back, so we can expect another Uno night.
That's
shortly.
Right, the shops are moving around and the people are moving around too. Cameron's due back and Tony Wickett has left.
Tony Wickett, cinematic impresario...
For Sortie Wood,
has pulled together a fairly ragtag bunch of creative types, and expects us to do great things. Which
Sawtelle Film Mafia.
That's sort of the idea, and he's also he's jolly excited about the idea of restarting Philosophy in the Pub, something that I foolishly suggested when we first moved up here about 6 or 7 years ago. And I think I was very, very drunk at the time. And
that's the problem, you see. This is the, as soon as I saw that you wanted to restart the philosophy in the pub, my first thought was pubs and philosophy, although they do go together to begin with, by the end of the evening, it's more just you're just burbling. And I'm with Cameron on this one, that we need a milk bar.
Okay.
Except I suppose you need philosophy in the pub because you get drunk enough to actually come up with some silly ideas which might have some legs to stand on eventually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the problem with philosophy in the pub originally, and that the only reason it went ahead was because having posted the suggestion on Yahoo or something, Dave and Fiona contacted me. This is how I met Dave and Fiona folks. And so then I was obliged to actually do it. And at the time, I was living up in Boambi East in the middle of nowhere. And a once a month visit to the Coffs Hotel, I got overexcited and overstimulated and used to drink way too much.
Like the big city there.
So yes, by half an hour in, I was totally incapacitated.
The whole Coffs know how exciting the philosophy in the pub must have been, because it was so damned exciting that the pub actually caught fire.
Yes,
and burnt to the ground.
Yeah,
because of those thoughts were obviously inflaming to the brain and to the surroundings.
I think it might, together with politics in the pub, which is at the same venue.
Surprised there wasn't rocks flung.
I strongly suspect some sort of CIA operation to torch the place in order to
way to keep Australia safe.
To stop this fomenting radicalism within the heartland of Coffs Harbour. Yes.
Good. Well, so we're going to start that up again.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm up for that. I might just have to try and encourage the pub to make hot chocolates occasionally.
I'm sure they can manage that.
Just to keep my brain working.
Tell them you're a pokey player. They'll do anything for you. This is the night we waited for. Come on tonight in our room for two.
International news?
International news.
Okay.
I must get some sort of stirring theme and the sound of typewriters and things like that.
That's a good idea.
Maybe a bit of Morse code.
No, a chattering telex machine.
A
chattering telex machine or a fax or, you know, one of those old printers. Yeah, okay. We'll have to do that. Elections. International.
I think with the last podcast, we announced that we have a new Prime Minister. On this one, we can announce that we do not have a Prime Minister at all.
We have no leader.
Except in a caretaker capacity.
Capacity.
Yes,
we have no leaders at all, which I quite like that. I actually like the fact that everyone's looking to all these nutty independents at the moment. So they had that Bob Catter guy. I think in the next 2 days, that would be for certain if the matter keeps unfolding. I said earlier today, many times I've gone to bed as a cock-a-doodle-doo and woken up the next morning as a feather duster. And this may be one of those times. I have no idea what he's talking about. It's just independent. Yes, so, and then there was the Family First Senator guy, who is left over from the previous election, who, I can't remember the guy's name now, but he's basically saying that he's going to block everything in the Senate for his remaining 6 months, if Labour gets in. So he no longer has a mandate, but he still thinks he can block everything unless it's something he wants. I'm a bit offended by him, purely because he's family first, really.
Yeah, so, this election is quite remarkable because it's been entirely politics-free. This is one of the points that Barry Jones was making on Philip Adams' program the other night, that the politics has completely gone out of politics. That's why you get election results like this that are so close, because there's actually nothing to determine the difference between the two parties. There's like...
That's why I was suggesting we have a tap dancing competition next time.
Mm.
Because there's no politics. They're all just saying nothing at all, basically. They're too afraid to say what their policies are.
They beat up issues out of non-issues, things like
boat people,
which we, is such a silly issue that just to talk about it insults the intelligence of everybody in the country. The fact is we're obliged because we signed the relevant, UN convention.
Let's not even talk about the boat people because it is, like you say, it's moronic to even consider that that's something that needs to be discussed. Yeah. There's other much more important things
which
they're not addressing.
And they're not addressing it for very good reasons because addressing serious issues of policy is what makes you enemies and what puts you in Kevin Rudd's position. Which is out of office.
Yes.
So given that they can't talk about anything of substance, they you know, this is just a popularity contest between two people who are virtually identical, with no state policies or promises, core or non-core. And I was reading an article in the Fin Review the other week saying that this election campaign has been absolutely fantastic. From the point of view of the right-wing think tank, the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia, because whoever gets voted in has said absolutely nothing about what they're going to do, so they're a completely blank slate to who can be sort of pushed in one direction or another by big business.
I almost wish that one of the major parties, would have the guts to step out and say exactly what they believe in the most extreme case, point out this is how it should be, and just sprinkle some salt into the recipe, give it some flavor and say, this is how it should be, even if it means that everyone goes, oh no, that's far too dangerous, can't do that, and they vote for the other party. Because I was thinking of a book by Robert Graves called I, Claudius, where he talks about the crazy senator, Roman senator, who voted in horses. And
Caligula.
Stuff. Caligula. And saying almost that they had to have Caligula before it could come good again. It had to go really crap, really bad, because everyone was saying, being morons, and they were all voting for the wrong people for the wrong reasons, not really thinking about it, not being political enough.
Mm.
So the idiot gets in who completely stuffs up everything, and then when he's out, that's when everyone goes, we need someone good now. And and in I, Claudius's case, it obviously wasn't working the same democratic election style, but the people in power made sure that he became the man in power, and everyone was thinking, well, who's this guy, he's an idiot, he doesn't know what he's doing, but he was an extremely good ruler. He was, thought things through and was very, sensible and did lots of really great things for Rome in a very humane way. And in many cases, I'm sure Sherry will point out how wrong I am being a historian, I always, in my simplistic political naive way, I always think that sometimes the mob, the crowd, Australia, were also short-sighted and don't really get political. We're all very lazy. We just vote for, whoever's going to give us the biggest baby benefit or the biggest car tax return or whatever, They're going to give you rewards. They pay you to vote. Yeah. And it's almost like we need to stuff up. But I guess that's probably too simple.
I don't know. I know during the 90s I was sort of involved on the fringes of various sort of radical groups of people who actually have fairly, more or less moderate and sensible opinions, but like to think of themselves as radicals because it's cool. a lot of that sort of student activist sort of crowd, particularly during the Howard years, it was like there was a sense of, wow, Howard's really making things really bad for a lot of people. Any minute now, the country's going to wake up and recognise that we are the intellectual vanguard of the revolution, and they're going to do what we say because we're the clever people who are going to lead them, selflessly lead the masses towards a brighter future.
You're pointing out the error of my argument here, because my argument relies on not looking back in the past to when I always used to think that. It's always like, well, it wasn't that bad how it was in. It's just really bad with, you know, but you're quite right.
I'm increasingly of the opinion that things have to get better before they can get better. things have sort of passed a line now where someone was observing, if you Google RSA vision videos, I've been watching a lot of these things. This is the British Royal Society of the Advancement of something and something else. Basically, about a bunch of, you know, sociologists talking to each other, and this essentially old style communist economist was saying that in public opinions, in surveys of the population in America at the moment, where people have just been completely crushed, their livelihoods taken away, and everything. The vast majority of them just blame themselves. They don't have any sort of feeling that the system has let them down, or that there are social sort of economic factors, that larger things are involved. They've just completely bought into the meritocracy idea that if they don't succeed, if they're having a hard time, it's because they've not worked hard enough, or they're not clever enough.
That's the big overriding success of capitalism and Thatcherism, is the individual is responsible for everything. It's the, you know, we're all individuals, and
I'm not.
So repeat after me. We're all individuals. Come on, everybody. I mean,
yes, there's no such thing as society, Margaret. Famously, yes. Pronounced.
Yes, which is
proclaimed.
Very sad, because it means that suddenly we're all going to be negotiating with our bosses about our wages, and it's just a big trick.
Yeah, and in Australia, that move was very evident. The in the 1980s, the banks started putting out ads saying that the great Australian dream was home ownership. I thought, I've never heard this before. But home ownership and things like compulsory superannuation mean that you have a very big stake in the status quo. You're not going to cause trouble because your security is deeply vested in the continued success of capitalism.
Hello, this is a very poor impersonation of Tony Benn. Having been a socialist for many, many years, it is my opinion that all progress must come from the bottom. And having listened to this program, I can thoroughly endorse these gentlemen, for, in my opinion, nobody is closer to the bottom than they are.
Yeah, I was having a bit of a rant.
You can see the pattern there. I'm always trying to get away from the politics as soon as we start talking about it, because I'm going, fucking politics.
I'll just complete my train of thought, because my high horse is so very high that once I get down off it, it's not worth getting back up.
Desperately trying to pull the rug out from under you, but please carry on.
As I was saying, you know, the worst things get, and I think that before things can get better, things have to get better. Now, that sounds like a really silly thing to say, but I firmly believe that unless there's, you know, some sort of grassroots move towards community building and education and building up people's awareness and involvement with the world around them, then you're not going to get anywhere. As miserable and oppressed and as desperate as people get, things aren't going to get any better as long as they're sustained by sort of myths of meritocracy and ridiculous fears of being swamped by foreigners and so on and so forth.
And outsourcing your problems too, or outsourcing the fixes to your problems. So that's what capitalism is for. It's for, you know, if you returning to an old drum for me, if you want to educate your children, you can ship them off to school so that you can continue your life as normal before you had kids. and your kids can be at school being looked after, save you the trouble.
Mm.
And that's not really falling into capitalism, that's more socialism, but but that's all I can say.
Anyway, so yeah, that's the sort of desperate situation we're in. On that theme of using personal wealth and personal belongings as a tool to keep people subjugated, you're about to say about leading the simple life.
Yes, you were talking about home ownership and objects, and how when people buy a house, suddenly they want everything to remain calm and they want the status quo because they want their house prices to increase.
Mm.
And so the idea is that then we're all going to be working towards having this. I suppose one theory might be that you then want to work towards having a lovely community, so that the community where this house is that you live in, the price will go up and you can sell it again. But of course, why would you sell out of this lovely community you've just built up? So that's not what actually happens. What actually happens is you buy a house and you paint the window frames and you stick some geraniums in the front yard and say, look, isn't it a lovely house? Look, it's got a swimming pool. And I hope that someone fool who's hoping house prices are going up will buy it, preferably about 20 or 30 fools, and the house prices then will go up because they all want to buy this house, but none of them want to live there, they just want to sell it again.
Yeah.
And of course that's where we're at now. We've done that until everyone's gotten sick of it, and now the house prices have plateaued and we've had this huge stock market crash around the world and credit crunch and stuff, and it seems like no one's actually learnt the lesson, because it feels like it's sort of bumped and now it's beginning to grind back on again, and you know, we're still not learning the lessons.
And it's
sorry,
I mean this again is a relatively modern phenomenon, the home ownership. I mean, go back a couple of generations and only a minority of the population would ever end up owning their own home. And that was perfectly fine. They lived perfectly full and happy lives, and there was no particular need to own their own
home. And I remember when I first went to buy a house, how scared I was of how tied down I'd be by this mortgage. You know, it's this terror I had of, you know, a mortgage and 2.5 kids, which is what the average person in England has. You know, this huge mortgage worth so much money, and they have to work and earn 250,000, you know, a year, or some, you know, huge amount of money just to pay for their mortgage. And so this is a case of one object, a home, tying you down. But of course, the other thing is you don't necessarily have to own a home. You can just rent a home, but then you can fill that home with objects. And if you have a rucksack full of objects and that's all you own, it's always easy to get up and move to another place. But of course, when you start having, you know, your guitar collection and your computer collection, Matthew, and, you know, your chairs and your tables and your sofas and your IKEA stuff, before you know it, you can't fit it in your rucksack anymore, and you have to hire a car, you know, or a van and shift it. And you know, this is what happens as we all get older. We collect stuff, and each of those objects seems to be a task, or a collection of tasks. You know, you've got this old sofa where you have to vacuum under the pillows, and you worry because, maybe in my case, the kids eat food on it and fungus starts to grow on the arms of the sofa.
Mm.
Or you might have carpets, you know, and you worry about them getting covered in pet hairs and having to vacuum them. And you might have exercise machines and you feel guilty because you don't use them.
Mm.
Or you might have a bicycle that you feel guilty for not using, or you haven't serviced it and it's got a puncture and you need to fix that puncture before you can use it. And you're just collecting all these jobs for yourself. My kids have Lego. They have so much Lego. And I always used to love Lego, but they've got so much Lego now that Lego to me has become something that is constantly on the floor and I have to pick up because my kids don't. And or else I can nag my kids to pick them up and feel like a bad parent because I have to nag my kids to pick them up.
Mm.
So again, objects creating guilt and jobs. And it's wonderfully freeing, I find, when you lose a lot of objects.
Mm.
At one time, even virtual objects. I've had hard drive crashes where I've lost everything, and my first feeling I get before the realization of, oh crap, it is actually relief. You know, I was like, oh, thank God for that. It just kind of pissed me off, like stuff, you know. And I remember moving away from a place once in Wales. I was living in this little student house, which I shared with a bunch of people, and the landlord had been rather unkind, and so we didn't feel particularly well disposed towards the landlord, and we all left without paying the last couple of weeks. So if the Welsh police are looking for me, I'm in Australia, so I left a lot of my stuff there because I just couldn't fit it into my rucksack. And I remember feeling a great sense of relief at having gotten rid of this onerous burden of all these things I had. I still regret all these cassette tapes of good music I used to have, which I left behind that place, and a nice jacket I had, and you know, they're all these things, but they're just things, you know. And if I really, really cared or really, really wanted those things again, I could actually probably earn the money and go and buy them again.
Yeah. I mean, one of my little epiphanies, because I think children feel this pressure to acquire stuff very, very strongly.
Definitely.
And they have this elevated expectation of the happiness that acquiring stuff is going to give them.
Mm-hmm.
I know my confession time. I when I was a teenager, I used to be an absolute demon shoplifter. I was the best of the best. Charles Dickens could have written a book about me. And it... Well, long story short, I got caught.
I would love to hear that story sometime. We could do a little show about that. One little segment about our crime.
Our crime past. History. Yeah. but
call it Fagin's Corner.
I've no idea how my parents didn't stop to think, well, he's getting five.
Talking. Here comes one of our little criminals now. Yes, my little criminal. What have you found?
It's a bit of my scab. Keep it well.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Keep it.
My 8-year-old son just came into the room, and he's been picking scabs whilst watching a video, and he's bought me the scab. It's very kind of him. Thank you, Matthew. You can have that for your dinner.
Yeah.
Lovely.
So,
anyway.
So, yeah, as I was saying, I've no idea how my parents could look at the sheer quantity of books and records and video cassettes and audio cassettes and so on and so forth that came into made its way into my bedroom and thought, my, he's able to stretch $5 a week of pocket money really far. He's obviously destined to a career
greatness.
In accountancy.
Greatness or the math.
Yeah, so, long story short, I got caught. I spent a bit of time in the back of a police car. The policeman.
I've
paid my debt to society. I spent a bit of time in a police car and in a police station watching a policeman two-finger type on a typewriter out a little report about me. And the funny thing is, the policeman. One of the cops turned around, and he obviously had this prepared speech that he gave to everybody who was in a similar, every kid that was in a similar situation. And he turned around and said, "So, what do you want to do when you leave school?" And you know, he's got a response for everybody who says, "Oh, I want to be a mechanic. I want to be a carpenter."
This is
or,
how it's
going to
affect your future life.
And I said, "Oh, I don't really know. I suppose I'll be a writer." And that threw him. He was not prepared for that question. And
well
he,
done, son. And you've collected a new experience.
Well, he didn't. I don't think he really knew what it was a writer did. So he didn't know how to apply the. Well, how do you expect to do this if you continue on the way you have?
You'll never learn to type like I have, doing things like this.
carried on shoplifting for a while, but. With a reduced degree of enthusiasm, and I kind of had this little epiphany of, what do I want all this stuff for? You know, I don't really need it all, and I can say fairly hypocritically that I've been anti-materialist ever since. I mean, hypocritically in that. You know, I've got quite a bit of stuff.
Everybody has stuff. You cannot get by without stuff. But and especially as a human being in this society, Western society that we live in, you get stuff forced down your throat. There's always stuff to buy. There's always improvements. There's always you know, and that would be okay if you threw stuff away. But then that's the other thing we have with stuff, is that the guilt of throwing things away. Like when my MP3, I've got an MP3 player, it's died, and I know that it has some wonderful bits of electronics in it. It's got an OLED screen, you know, which is great. It's like a piece of, you know, visual candy when you press it, you know, it lights up and does things, but it's broken, it doesn't work. But I find it really hard to throw it out. And I have an old digital camera. It has a bit of sand in the lens mechanism. The camera works, but the lens doesn't come out, so it doesn't work. So I have to, I've bashed it a lot on the table to try and get the sand out, but it doesn't work. So I'm going to have to throw it out. But, you know, and this is where you get these nutty government recycling schemes where they encourage school children to stick a light bulb on the end of a coat hanger and call it art, you know, and that's supposed to make you feel better about throwing this stuff away because you're recycling it.
Yeah.
So stuff.
Yeah,
anyway, that was my little rant about stuff. I mean, I've got more to say about that, and we could go on all day, but I don't think might become very, fairly vacuous. More vacuous than my usual stuff. So we'll stop there, and we could move right along. Talk about WikiLeaks, perhaps.
WikiLeaks. This is very interesting. I claim this is very interesting. The US government and media response has been that it's simultaneously the gravest and most serious threat to civilization ever, and nothing of any importance. They're both saying that this is absolutely scandalous and must stop, and at the same time saying absolutely nothing that we didn't already know has been revealed.
Oh, and the guy revealing it all, he's probably a rapist anyway. Or not. I'll just quickly withdraw those charges before you look at them too closely. And who knows, perhaps by the time this podcast gets released, we'll release something else about him, like he was a hacker. Oh, hang on, we've already done that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like it's the beginning of a campaign of they'll say lots of nasty things about him, and they'll all be unsubstantiated.
And I wondered why. Because, I mean, I've been conscious of WikiLeaks for a long time and thought, oh, this is a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only been in the last year or so that I've even known the name Julian Assange. And it seems to me that they reached some point where they thought, well, we've got this big load of important stuff that we're sitting on, and it's almost like he's volunteered to be the focus of public attention to draw it away from the rest of the organization so it can keep ticking over. And while he's doing this sideshow thing of appearing to the media and then disappearing and doing the Salman Rushdie appearing and disappearing act,
yes,
being simultaneously in the public eye and whereabouts unknown, he seems to be doing this with a view to keeping the organisation ticking over and keeping people worried about someone who's essentially a figurehead at this point in time.
Yes. I was talking to Cameron about him before Cameron went away to Bali for his trip with his family, and he was saying how he doesn't like Julian
Assange.
Assange. I was going to say asinine. That's not right. Yeah, he didn't like him because of his bombast. You know, he was talking about how there was some news article I saw about some raid in, he was in somewhere, was it Africa? And there was a raid in this place, and he's sort of, the people were saying, well, was it just a plain old burglary? And they were saying, well, why would it be when there's someone as important as me here?
Uh-huh.
And they were sort of saying, bit up yourself, aren't you? And I don't know, perhaps he is, perhaps he isn't. But that's beside the point, you know. If personally, he might be a big-headed tosser, you know. But I think what he's doing is very valuable and interesting, and it's something which I don't know. He's destined to draw flak from, especially the American government and probably many other ones.
He's often, these days, being mentioned in the same breath as Dan Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers in the late 60s.
I don't know Dan.
Okay. So Dan Ellsberg was the basically he was employed by various presidential administrations to be an intelligence advisor and whatnot, and he was an employee of the RAND Corporation and all these sort of shadowy sort of think tanky, you know, intelligence-y type organizations. Mm-hmm. And so he was privy to a great deal of information about the what was going on during the Vietnam War that was not being publicly exposed, because up until the late 60s, it was always the same sort of story that we're hearing now about Iraq and Afghanistan. It's things have been a bit tough, but we're about to turn a corner, and the signs are all very promising that any time now, victory will be achieved. And that was the story sort of right up till the late 60s, whereas Noam Chomsky said big business started getting tired of the war, and it was then acceptable to start questioning it. So Dan Ellsberg basically spent hours and hours and hours photocopying documents and then trying to get them published. And he had a devil of a time, I think, partly because he would approach a newspaper and get them to publish some of the information, and then the government would would put an injunction on them saying, you know, you can't do this because of, you know, X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. And I think also, to a large extent, the media were not interested, because, you know, it's just not the sort of story that we're interested in.
I get the impression the media hasn't been particularly interested in the content of what we're
thinking. No. And I think that's a very similar story. And I think they've been very clever in the way that they've released this huge tranche of data by going to three separate media organisations and essentially saying that if you don't print this, your competition are going to. So I think he got that exposed to a wider audience than he would have got it exposed to if he just put it online. Yeah. By being very clever in the way that he managed the media.
Yes, well, that's the thing. You imagine that the vast internet out there, you could publish any old crap and no one's necessarily going to look at it.
I mean, yeah.
So yes. When did you last go? I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never gone to WikiLeaks for my news. It's an interesting time, I think, for news reporting around the world, because, you know, newspapers are in decline, and yet I don't know if they're all in decline. I mean, there's mind you, I could very well be wrong, but I don't know if everyone's going to read news entirely online, because not everyone has iPods and not everyone wants to cart a laptop to the toilet with them to read the paper.
Yeah.
You can't wipe your bum on a computer.
No.
There's not an iPhone app for that.
You can't line a budgie cage with a PDF.
Maybe there is an iPhone app for that. If not, we could develop one. You know, yeah. Some sort of thing where you can let your budgies poop on your iPod and, well, I can just do that anyway, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think, yeah, I read a quote from Marshall McLuhan a while ago. Oh, Marshall McLuhan, doesn't he sound very intellectual?
He does. He sounds like someone from Monty Python, actually.
But, he was basically saying that each new medium starts out by consuming the content of the past one, but that doesn't sort of persist. So, I mean, if you look at the early days of television in the UK, it was all sort of play of the day or whatever,
and vaudeville stand-up,
you would be pulling the people off the music hall circuit, like Morecambe and Wise or whatever, and you'd be you know, taking plays and just sticking the actors in front of a camera and getting them to do it exactly as they would have done it on stage. But over time, the medium evolves, and well, actually, that's a bad example. Music hall is not doing too well, but it did not completely kill the stage, and in the same way that VHS and DVDs have not killed cinema, or there will be a role for newspaper, and I think it's
that's a thing. It's like we're just adding to our richness with all these different mediums, because you know, we still paint pictures just like cavemen did on the walls of caves, but we also have movies in 3D even. Yeah. Don't know why you'd have them in 3D, but
yeah.
So yes, news sources can come from many places. Yeah. I suppose is what we're saying.
Yeah. So I mean, I always get Friday's Financial Review, and if I had more time and money, I'd buy a lot more print publications. But Friday's Financial Review, I never miss out on because it has the section with all the long essays and reviews and opinion pieces in it.
I was listening to along the same lines. I was listening to a podcast with A.S. Byatt, the English author, and she was talking about how we pick our news sources. I'm paraphrasing everything here, but she was saying we pick our news sources. So, you know, you'll read the articles in the paper you're interested in, or you'll go to the internet and you'll pick out, you'll subscribe to the feeds you're interested in. And, you know, we all do this. Mm. And she was saying that the problem with that is it starts to become dry and barren and stale. And she actually started forcing herself to read the entire paper.
Mm.
Even the stuff she wouldn't normally read. I mean, I don't know if she went as far as to read the sports pages on the back page or not, but she read everything because she said that would uncover pearls of stuff she hadn't have ever been interested in before. I suppose my experience of that is the bridge column in The Guardian. I don't play bridge. I couldn't even begin to understand how to play bridge. But the man who writes the bridge column in The Guardian writes about it so beautifully that I wish I did understand bridge, because he explains it all very clearly, still not clear enough for me, but it's written so well. I encourage you to actually go, and I think it's Mir Mahmoud or something, I can't remember his name now, but yeah, I encourage you to read it, because it's a pleasure to read. But you know, things like that where you've uncovered articles, and some of my favourite things I've read have been in completely random places where you don't expect to find them.
Yeah.
And the same as, you know, watching things too. Like, I've watched things which I just didn't expect to enjoy. And, you know, I guess that's the beauty of more and more outlets for information. It means more and more eclectic ways to collect it.
Yeah, yeah. And I had a discussion with Martin Van Valuen. Did I mention this on a previous podcast? No, I don't believe I did. So Martin Van Buren, who did the sound on a couple of the local short films we've been doing, and who is also a musician, he does a TAFE course for audio engineering, and he said to me that when digital audio first came in, and it's became radically cheaper for people to do what he does, he thought, oh well, this is it, this is my livelihood gone. But the thing is, when the actual physical resources necessary to do thing X become very, very cheap, then the valuable part of the equation is the person who has the skills to actually do it well.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that people have the resources necessary to do what he does, the more people have the resources necessary to do what he does, doesn't make what his primary value less valuable. It makes the skills and the experience that he has infinitely more valuable, because more people can make use of it,
mean that my children will have a future building Lego buildings for virtual Lego games.
Well, possibly. But I mean, in the context of newspapers, that
journalists should be the publishers.
Well, that editorial skill, the thing that
because I don't want to, looking at WikiLeaks now, I don't want to read the CIA Red Cell Memorandum on United States exporting terrorism. I mean, that sounds fascinating, but I really don't want to read some photocopied report on WikiLeaks about that.
No.
I'd rather read some journalist who I trust.
Yeah.
I'd like to read what they think of it.
Yeah.
Because I can't just start to form my own opinions about that, because seriously, I mean, the CIA is on the other side of the world, and news is just entertainment.
Yeah. So, I mean,
arguably,
if you've got things like WikiLeaks providing the raw data, the source material, and you've got loads and loads of people who are more than willing to devote time to doing the analysis and drawing everything together because this is, you know, the thing that
they
enjoy, then what becomes valuable? And I think, I'm increasingly thinking that what becomes valuable is that editorial eye, the ability to pick out articles from all sorts of ranges of subjects and bring them together into a collection that anybody can sit down to and say, well, I never imagined I'd be interested in this subject, but here it is, and it's totally interesting. I think how that becomes a business model, I don't know, and I don't care. Everybody looks at this the wrong way around, I think. Everybody's thinking, well, where's the business model? And if you start thinking from the point
it's
of view of where's
the
business model first off, then you start doing the stupid Rupert Murdoch thing and think, well, I'm just going to put up a toll booth and nobody gets to my stuff without paying the toll. But that's...
Nobody goes there anymore.
Yeah. I think you should approach it from this other direction, which says, well, okay, something that used to be scarce and expensive has now just become plentiful and virtually free.
I feel like The Guardian is making a good try about the website. I think I've mentioned them before too. I mean, I really like The Guardian website.
Yeah.
And I think that they have a good balance. Yeah. Sometimes actually their website's a bit broken, but generally, you know, So
what in this new environment is the scarce and valuable resource, and it could be that, you know,
yeah, it could be the editorial.
You could be paying your own personal editor to give you things that are of interest to you, or things that you don't know will be of interest to you, but could be, and. I think the various digs or whatever, the various automated systems for trying to do that have shown that you can't do that in an automated way. But I
think there's a value in those automated digs and so forth.
Because I
think that what could happen is you could actually end up with your personal editor. But the thing is, I don't just read The Guardian website, for instance. And I don't just read The Advocate or, you know, whatever I read. I don't just read a particular thing. I'll read tons of stuff, you know, and just pick and cherry pick from the things I'm interested in. And I suppose I'm reading things from many different editorial archives, which have been put together by different organizations. And I don't necessarily want to read them all. So really what I'm wanting is my own publication, like you're saying. We're talking internet world here and personal devices you can read in the bog. Then it's going to be a bunch of different editorial collections all pulled together by some automatic dig type mechanism, you know, where other people who also read those things, maybe people who I admire or who people I have similar views to, like, you know, if you and I both read the same Boing Boing, whatever, then we might put a little gold star next to the thing we just enjoy reading, which would, or even post about it on microblog. I mean, we're already doing it.
We're
already doing it.
I think the danger there is that you start to whittle down the sorts of things that you're reading to sort of the things that interest you most, and think you don't get so much coming at you out of left field.
That comes back to what I was saying earlier about having to read the entire paper just to make sure you read something which is enlightening or something which is outside of your usual remit, something which is going to surprise you. And it's always good to be surprised.
There was one other thing I wanted to mention news-wise is I was very saddened to hear that Christopher Hitchens has been diagnosed with cancer, and he does not hold out much hope of living to a advanced age anymore. Christopher Hitchens, you probably know as a bombastic English journalist of a kind that you don't see very much anymore. He's based in the US most of the time, I think. But I always being, I remember being quite struck by him when he presented a documentary series on the US when I was in my late teens. A real old-fashioned, crumpled shirt, constantly smoking, constantly drinking type of journalist who, I agree with him on most things, with the exception of Iraq and Saddam Hussein. He came out very, very heavily in favour of invading Iraq in 2003. But on other matters, I'm much more sympathetic with him. He and Richard Dawkins both want to see the Pope arrested. He's long campaigned for the arrest of Henry Kissinger.
I would love to see Pope arrested, and
that would be so funny. And he's just generally a fun figure. He wrote a book about Mother Teresa called The Missionary Position, which basically exposed her as what she is, basically a sadist, who an egomaniac who's entirely driven by personal desire for sainthood. He said in an interview that he wanted to call the book Holy Cow, but the publishers wouldn't stand for that. So he's quite an entertaining sort of gadfly type figure, and I'll be very sad to see him go.
Yes, I don't follow the different journalists with the same sort of fanboyism that you do. Oh, if you'll forgive me,
there are not many that I think.
But at the same time, I have faces, journalists who I like, and I do. I can see why you would follow them all. But
speaking of beloved journalists,
yes.
you can see a link coming, can't you? Almost a year ago to the day, a columnist by the name of Keith Waterhouse died at the age of 80. Peacefully in his sleep, as well as being one of Britain's most beloved newspaper columnists. He retired a few years ago, much to the despair of his readership. He was also a journalist of the old school. Again, you know, a long lunch, dishevelled, sort of vodka martini kind of journalist.
He would have written for the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
He would have done. He would have done.
I'm quite sure.
And among his more famous works was a play called Geoffrey Bernard is Unwell. You might recall Peter,
yes,
O'Toole playing the title role there, which was basically a celebration of the life of, the ultimate dissolute Fleet Street figure of the old days.
Yes.
But the work for which Keith Waterhouse is most well known around the world is a book, stage play, and film called Billy Liar. And I recently forced you to sit down and watch that, and we're going to have a little chat about it. What did you think of it?
I very much enjoyed it. It really, I feel like a knob saying this, but it resonated for me from when. And I'm sure it would for lots of people from suburbia or small towns or anyone who doesn't live in the centre of the universe, which is all of us, because there's that whole thing about fear of doing what you want to do because you're afraid that you might fail. And this film was all about that, I thought. I thought he was constantly fantasising about how wonderful life would be if he was the leader of, you know, some banana republic with his big hat and brocades and you know, medals, with the women all fawning after him. And
it was a big day for us. We had won the war in Ambrosia. Democracy was back once more in our beloved country.
It was all lovely, you know, in his imagination, but in real life it was becoming more and more and more dismal in a very mundane way. All brought about by him being such a fool, because he wasn't actually saying what he really believed because he was too gutless. And I know that you know, I'd fit into that mold fairly, you know, regularly. And because quite often, you know, in your work situation or in your just out in the street situation, you'll smile and nod when you actually feel like, but you don't.
Mm.
And yeah, I loved it. It was a great film. And I was disappointed with the end, though. I like you said earlier, you said it was an inevitable ending. But when he are we going to talk about endings of this film? And it's,
yeah,
it's,
why not?
It was made in 1947, so no, surely everyone's seen it by now.
1963. So there's no big spoilers.
1963. No, that's right. The Walter Mitty film was made in 1947, which is another film I was going to watch because I read the Walter Mitty book, Walter Mitty short story years ago, and that's what Billy Lyre immediately reminded me of.
So I mean, apparently, according to Wikipedia, the film belongs to the British New Wave movement or kitchen sink drama, and there's definitely an aspect of the film which is angry young man-ish. And I first,
it's not as gritty as Look Back in Anger.
No, but
it's much funnier.
Yes, I first saw the film when I was a teenager, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic, and clearly resonated with me growing up in suburbia and all the rest of it, with you know, aspirations to be all sorts of wonderful things, but kind of also self-sabotaging, because actually having the courage to do any of those things was completely beyond me.
And actually, there's also that aspect. I'm trying to think where it was covered in the film, but which rung true for me was where you almost have the courage to do it. So you take the first step, which is the step that puts you in the shit.
Mm.
And what you need to do then is take the following step through to get out of the shit and beyond.
To
be brave. But what happens instead is you take that first step, which everyone turns and looks at you to wait and see what you'll do, and you realize everyone's looking, and you falter. And that's what Billy Lyre was doing the whole way through the film. He kept taking, he's trying to be different, and he's trying to get out there. And he's telling everyone of his dreams.
I said, I have been offered a job in London.
What bloody job?
How do you mean you've been offered a job?
A job script writing.
Script writing? He can't write his own bloody names so that anybody can read it.
How do you mean script writing?
I've told you, Boone. Danny Boone, the television comedian. He's in town today opening the new supermarkets. Well, I sent him some of my scripts. He's read them. He's read them and he likes them. He sent me this letter. Look. He's offered me a job in London, script writing. He likes my material.
What do you mean he likes your material?
And I was talking to you about this earlier too, about the fragility of your dreams when you talk about them, you know, in a podcast, for instance, and you tell the world all about what your plans are and what you dream of doing, and sabotage yourself in doing so. You reveal to the world what you might do. Suddenly everyone's turning and going, so when are you doing that thing that you said you'd do? And in Billy Lyre's case, the things he's going to do just grow and grow and grow, because suddenly he has to make excuses for why he hasn't done it yet. He can't just make an excuse. He can't just tell the truth and say, because I haven't pulled my finger out yet. Instead, it becomes something more complex, and he can't do it because there's some other grand scheme getting in the way, you know.
Mm.
And yes, and I it's a wonderful film because it's paced so well. But we're at the stage where the glamorous blonde girl arrives, who's quite nice looking, quite sensible, quite brave. She's going to go to London, and when he meets her, he's sort of saying to her, he starts spinning some bullshit to her up on the balcony.
Mm.
and she pulls up on it, because everyone else knows Billy's lying when he's spinning his yarns, but they let him go because I don't know why, but they let him go. But she pulls him up and says,
"How's the script writing and Arthur and that book? How's that book coming along?"
"I finished it. It's going to be published next Christmas."
"Count five and tell the truth."
"Well, I haven't started writing yet."
"Oh, bad as ever."
And it's lovely that he can be honest with her. And so you immediately have hope for him. You think, oh God, maybe he's going to go and live out his dreams with this woman.
The wonderful Julie Christie playing Liz.
Julie Christie, that's of course yes. who it was. I was trying to...
The crux of the story is that he lives in a fantasy world and in several fantasy worlds and also has sort of in addition to the to what he knows of fantasies, he has these delusions that he holds deeply and sincerely for the moment that he has them, and then, as you say, backpedals furiously and has to start dissembling in order to pull himself out of that situation, thereby just making the situation work and the you know elaborate series of lies that he has to tell and maintain, you know, eventually bring him undone.
Oh, no, you see, there's been a bit of a misunderstanding.
No, it wasn't a misunderstanding, Fisher. No, it's just that 200 or 300 calendars didn't get posted, to my knowledge. We've got to get this cleared up, you see, Fisher. We've got to get it cleared up and implemented.
If it's a question of payment,
Now, wait a minute, wait just one little minute. It's not as easy as that, you see. There's the goodwill to consider.
Yes, so that Liz character knows him better than anybody else does. To everybody else, he's just... incomprehensible.
And she's also the only worldly character there because she's the one that's been to London. Yes. She's the one that's escaped. And so when he's rumbled with the boy, you know, he's with her in the woods and he's telling her all about his secret land and he's, you know, coming clean about his lies. And then his workmate and his workmate's drunken pals are all listening in and they tease him about it and then run away laughing. And you get from the actor, Julie Christie, who did she play? Liz.
Liz, yeah.
Liz. From her, you can see that she's thinking, well, this doesn't matter because we're going to London. And once we're left, once we're out of here, who'll care about this small little world and these people?
Whoever out there's going to get the bastard teeth knocked down their throats.
I'm the Prime Minister and you're the Foreign Secretary. Or something.
Leave them, Billy. Oh, leave them. Worth it. The whole place isn't worth it.
Bastards.
But Billy can't help but be upset by it, and he has to run after them, shaking. You know, he's furious with them, and really upset because you know they now know his secret, and he's going to get teased about that on Monday when he goes to work, and you know it'll be all around town before you know it. And that's the thing, when you live in a small world, you can't conceive what it's like to be outside of that small world until you get out of it. And once you poke your head out, it makes me think of that, is it medieval woodcut of the person sticking their head out of the dome that is the world. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's a lovely illustration. I shall post it on Sawtelle.org.
Okay.
I know I always promise I'll send you these things, and I never do. My special sound effects, my special pictures and links, but I shall send the picture. The picture that you will see before you download the podcast, if you go to the website, shall be the picture of the little medieval man poking his head outside of the world. Of course, no one quite knows what's outside there because we haven't been out yet.
Well, I mean, this I think the whole reason that this film resonated so much with me when I was a teenager was that that world of 1950s, early 1960s England, sort of post-war, still quite austere and dull and drab, and being in black and white assisted that tremendously in the film.
And all the houses being knocked down after the war because they're all still
replaced by concrete bunkers, tower blocks, or suburban sprawl. I think Australia in the 1970s and 80s. Was still very much in that vein. I don't think we had sort of a cultural revolution the way that the US and England had. In Australia in the 60s and 70s, the fashions just got a lot worse. But everything
you never had quite such close proximity of living introduced suddenly.
Yeah.
Because suddenly we went from these, I don't know, the romantic sort of pre-war England was all villagey and the towns, you know, they were more, they had the baker and they had the butcher and all of the sort of communities, whereas after the war these these entire places were just swept away and blown up and bombed, and then replaced with, and the opening scenes of Billy Liar just have the camera moving along, all these identikit houses all joined together, you know, and you know that each of those houses contains a family, and they're all fermenting together, you know, and they, you know, I find it very reminiscent of, I mean, I didn't grow up in that situation, but I mean, I grew up in a farmhouse in Cornwall, so I guess I was lucky in that respect. But at the same time, I did live in a small, or near a small town, and you know everybody, and everyone knows your business, and they know that, you know, what happens to you and the kind of person you are, and well, the kind of person that you are in that environment. And breaking out of that was a wonderful thing to do, but perhaps it was easier for me because I didn't actually live so closely entwined with these lives of all the people in the houses joining up with each other like they are in Billy Liar. And the same in Australia. I mean, the houses here, they have bigger yards. You don't actually, you can go outside of your house and lay on the lawn and scratch your belly, and you don't actually have to have a conversation with the person next door because you're not lying across their front step.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not raining.
Well, which is, I think it's a bad thing. I think it's fine if you want to live in suburbia, but that expectation that that's the only way that you can live is absolutely crippling for this country, I think. A certain class of person will go off to university and spend a few years living in a squat in Newtown or something and live the bohemian lifestyle, but then they get a job and they move out to the suburbs and that's it. They live like everybody else and think fondly of their bohemian days. But
do we still live like that? Do children, or teenagers still grow up feeling like that, do you think? I mean, I was listening to this podcast recently about the Beatles and John Lennon, and they're talking about how when the Beatles first started off, they were like the Billy Liar scenario, you know, there was no social mobility, especially in England. You know, it's all very caste driven, and you're born in this neighborhood and you're going to grow up in this neighborhood, you're going to work in the factory and you're going to own the mill or whatever, and this is what you'll do. Whereas during the 60s, the Beatles, during that period, I'm not saying the Beatles changed that, but the Beatles period, the social mobility changed, where suddenly some bloke from suburbs in Liverpool somewhere could be living in Los Angeles having released all these records and become a multi-squillionaire and
be looked up to. I mean, I have
be admired by people of all classes.
I have a friend who's from Liverpool and is of that, of the Beatles generation, and you know, he says that John Lennon was always one of his heroes, and that would be quite a novelty to have a hero that was who was from the place that you were from and was of your class and wasn't, you know, the Duke of whatever.
Yes, some person you could never be.
Mm.
Whereas at least John Lennon, you feel like you could actually aspire to be someone who gets to those heady heights without having been to university or having the right blood in your veins.
Mm.
The other thing I was going to say about Billy Liar was I just loved all those. There was a couple of scenes there. There was one where the two blokes are walking out fairly near the beginning of the movie, Billy and the guy from The Likely Lads.
Rodney Bewes.
Rodney Bewes. And they're both walking along and they're talking my ear when I were a lad.
I started out as a councillor. I had public conveniences I had then to look after. Now tells a young councillor in them
days. I knows all this for fields when I were a lad, Charlie.
Well, I had no but one clog on my feet in them days, all right. Well, I tell you what, I mean, the workers nowadays, you see, you give them chump and serpent a week, they're not contented.
They don't know the bone.
They don't know when they're well off.
They couldn't come it with me.
No.
There's always been an all right, it's all right, and all right. By hell, there always will be.
Right. See, nowadays, young lads, they come down with the college ways, and they want none of it.
It was a proto-Monty Python skit there. Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah, yeah. And then later on, he's up in the hills, and he meets the councillor up in the hills.
Councillor Duxbury.
Councillor, and they do the same skit there as well. Yeah. And it was excellent. I just thought that was fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
It made it funny all over again.
Yeah. There is something about that...
Northern accent. There's something about that northern accent, and you and I were lad.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's why this is thought of as being, you know, an angry young man type film, because it is being very disrespectful to tradition and to a vision of England as being, you know, those cap-doffing commoners from up north.
It's Mickles or Muckles.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It was a good expression of the feelings you have when you're trapped in a society of old farts. Well, I'm about done.
Okay. I think we can wrap it up there. Having recommended that film, I've just realised I have absolutely nothing to say about it, except you should go and watch it.
Enjoyed that film.
Yes.
They should show it at the Sawtelle Cinema.
They should.
If I had a cinema, I'd be showing films like that. I don't know where I'd get the reels from. Maybe I could do it digitally. But it would be wonderful, wouldn't it, to have your own movie, have a lend of a movie theatre every Thursday night or something.
And just program it.
Just say, well,
Yeah,
you get some good old films, because there's some fantastic old stuff, you know, to watch. Charlie Chaplin.
There's so much stuff out there that this is why copyright should expire within a reasonable period of time, because there's so much fantastic stuff that if copyright expired after 7 years or 14 years or even 21 years, we would now be able to just grab a copy and give it to someone and say, look at this, it will change your life.
This is great stuff to watch, but instead we have to...
Another discussion for another time.
Yeah, I'm going to have a lollipop and see how Emrys is doing with that movie.
Okay, we'll call this a podcast.
Indeed. This is the night we waited for. Come on tonight in our room for two. Someone else, send someone else to find
and all of them, snake, blood spurting everywhere, and of
I
course,
really don't understand what
awfully,
what are we worried about the snakes for? They're perfectly natural in this environment.